Hello and welcome to Accent of Women, a show by and about women from diverse cultures and languages right across the world. I'm Giselle Hannah. Tuesday the 1st of May is May Day. That's International Workers' Day, a day where workers right across the world realise their collective power and single struggle against capital, against dirty bosses, and against an economic system that is designed to exploit us for the profit of others. On today's Accent of Women, we celebrate May Day and continue the worldwide struggle for workers' rights. We look at two parts of the world where workers are struggling for economic and social justice. That's the Philippines and Korea. In the second part of the show, we'll speak to Wolsan Liam, the Director of International Affairs for the Korean Public Transport Workers Union. She'll be discussing the historic agreement for peace between North and South Korea and the role of the union movement towards this peace agreement. But first up on the show, we look at workers' rights in one of the poorest countries of the world, the Philippines. My guest is Stephanie Rabusa, chairperson of Anak Bayan Melbourne, a youth Filipino organisation. She's also a member of Migrante Australia and Gabriela Australia. I start off by asking Steph what the biggest issues are facing the Filipino workers today.
There are many issues facing Filipino workers at the moment, but one of the biggest issues, of course, is unemployment. So currently there are still around 11.5 million Filipinos who are without work or who are still looking for more work. There are millions of citizens in low-paying and insecure work with little or no benefits. I think at the moment the unemployment rate in the Philippines is at least at 6.6%. Another biggest issue, which the Kilusang Mayo Uno or the May 1st movement is trying to campaign on, is contractualization. So they have this campaign called End Endo, and endo means the end of contract, which is a practice in the Philippines where companies terminate a worker's contract before the 6 months of employment. At the moment in the Philippines, the law requires companies to regularize their workers after 6 months. But, you know, to prevent workers from actually getting permanency and proper work entitlements, they terminate their contracts before the 6 months is due. So that's a really, really big problem in the Philippines right now. Another problem is the increase in minimum wage. The minimum wage at the moment is very, very low as well. It's only around 502 pesos a day, which is around 15 Australian dollars. And the labor movement in the Philippines has been campaigning for a rise for many, many years now to 750 pesos a day, which is around 18 dollars, Australian dollars. The actual living wage is actually around 27 Australian dollars. So you can imagine that that is that 750 pesos a day is actually nearer the living wage than the actual minimum wage that is currently in the Philippines.
Well, given the poverty and the unemployment that you've just described, it's no wonder that workers are the biggest export product of the Philippines. Where do these migrant workers end up, and what are the conditions like normally for them in those host countries?
Okay, so there are around, I think now, more than 1.8 million Filipinos working abroad. A lot of those Filipinos are actually working in the seafaring industry, which accounts for around 25% of the world's seafarers. It's really big. There's around 10 million Filipinos with 4.9 million of them are permanent settlers, and 4.2 million are temporary migrants out of the 10 million Filipinos overseas. A lot of them are in Saudi Arabia of those temporary migrant workers. I think one third of the temporary migrant workers are actually in Saudi Arabia. So most what we call OFWs or overseas Filipino workers are in the Middle East. There's also a lot of undocumented workers all over the world, which is around 1.2 million Filipinos. Also, currently, there's a lot of Filipino women who are visible in international migration. They are now 60. They now account for 65% of land-based migrants now. So there's a lot of women workers out of the country. In most countries where temporary workers are based, most of the conditions are very difficult. They face a lot of abuse, mostly on a daily basis. According to statistics, every day at least three Filipino workers die abroad. There's also a lot of discrimination, a lot of physical abuse, underpayment, sexual harassment, among other things. So, those are the things that these workers face every day outside of the country.
Often we say that people's living and working conditions are a direct correlate with the size and power of the labour movement. The Philippines is a very militant labour movement. Why is the struggle so intense there?
I think the struggle is intense because of the worsening problems Filipino workers are currently facing. Now, Filipinos has a rich history of fighting back, since the colonial era. I think that with what the labor movement in the Philippines has done and all other sectors and sectoral movement in the Philippines is that they have given Filipinos a platform to see the contradictions in the country, and they have never really stopped arousing, organizing, and mobilizing workers. Also, the union movement in the Philippines is also very active in educating workers of the root causes of their struggles. And so workers understand and not only call for pay increases or increases in entitlements, but they go beyond that and call for, root causes of their problems, and the solutions that they think are going to better their situations, like the call for national industrialization and, genuine land reform.
There's also a vibrant and militant women's movement as well. What are some of the major demands of working women in the Philippines?
So the major demands of the women in the Philippines are mostly the same as what the labor movement demands. Like right now, women still count among the poorest sectors in the countries. They work more 40 hours or more, and that excludes hours spent on, domestic responsibilities. Also, of course, there is a big campaign and big call for the end of violence against women. According to reports, there rape incidences, sexual harassment, and that are actually increasing. So despite what the government is saying in terms of decrease in violence, violence against women are actually increasing. So that is one of the biggest calls of the women's movement in the Philippines.
Well, Steph, thank you so much for your time on the show today. Of course, it's International Workers' Day. It's May Day. Yep. Do you have any final comments?
Yes. So I think my only comment is, join the May Day rallies that are ongoing at the moment. Learn about the worker struggles and, of course, join your union.
And on community radio stations right across Australia, you're listening to Accent of Women. Today, we're celebrating May Day and continuing the struggle for workers' rights right across the world. You just heard from Steph Rabusa from Anak Bayan, a youth Filipino organisation that works towards the rights of Filipino workers. My next guest is Walsan Liam, the International Director of the Korean Public Transport Workers Union. On Friday, the 27th of April, we saw historic events in North and South Korea with the signing of the Panmunjom Declaration for Peace, Prosperity and Unification. It's not the first time that there's been progress on this front, that of the unification of North and South Korea and a formal declaration to the end of the war. So what makes this agreement different? To discuss this point and more, Walsan Liam.
So there, which the Panmunjom Declaration is very similar to past agreements, particularly the one made between the North and South Korean leaders in 2007. But just in terms of the wording, there's some wording in this agreement that is more specific, particularly talking about pursuing a declaration of the end of the Korean War and a peace treaty, the signing of a peace treaty through either trilateral or quadrilateral meetings within this year, the 65th anniversary of the Korean War. So that is that's the specificity of that was caught a lot of people's attention. And the other thing is North Korea's the confirmation of the goal of complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. But in addition to the wording, I think what makes this agreement different is the context in which it's happening. So North Korea has made real commitments to work towards full denuclearization, including agreeing to close down its site where it's done nuclear tests, the last six nuclear tests, which is a real step. They said they're going to do it within May. And of course, this happens right before a summit is scheduled to happen between the United States and North Korea to talk about much more specific pathway towards not just denuclearization, but also measures towards giving North Korea the security assurances it needs to be able to give up its nuclear weapons. And so that broader context of steps already going forward, I think, makes things really different. Here's another thing, just in terms of North and South Korean cooperation, the South Korea has gone forward to actually dismantle the loudspeakers it has set up at the DMZ that blare propaganda at North Korea, and is also North Korea is going forward to actually the time is different in North and South Korea. North Korea is 30 minutes behind South Korea in terms of time, and North Korea just came out with a statement that they're going to match the clocks on May 5th. And so there are these actual real things that are happening that makes all of this look like it's going to move forward more quickly than we've seen in the past.
You talked about denuclearization, and the KPTU has pointed out that real denuclearization necessarily means that the US also denuclearizes. What are the chances of that actually happening?
We were trying to point out in our statement that the root causes of North Korea's nuclear development is a real threat. Or real or perceived threat from the United States, embodied in things like the United States policy that it can carry out a preemptive nuclear attack on North Korea, having threatened North Korea with the attack of nuclear weapons, not only in the past, but also very recently, providing a nuclear umbrella over South Korea, using sending nuclear strategic assets to participate in war games together with the South Korean military, which target North Korea's, they simulate the downfall or the overthrow of the North Korean government. And so all of these things are obviously very threatening acts which have caused North Korea to feel like it has to develop nuclear weapons and has been a justification, for better or worse, of the North Korean nuclear program. And so what we're saying, and North Korea has also said this too, that actually North Korea is saying very clearly these days, we don't want to live with nuclear weapons. Actually, we want the United States to come out and say very clearly, it will not attack us with nuclear weapons, make a promise, sign an agreement, say that it will not send its nuclear weapons to the peninsula, and then we can denuclearize. North Korea is actually not saying that the United States has to give up all of its thousands of nuclear warheads, which we don't think is going to happen before the Korean Peninsula denuclearizes. In fact, we are hoping that we can have a peace treaty, security assurances, and real improvement of relationships between South and North Korea and North Korea and the United States, as well as surrounding countries, so that North Korea can give up its nuclear weapons. And then after that, or, you know, going forward from there, we, of course, continue to have a real global fight for full denuclearization of the United States and other nuclear powers. But that's probably going to take much longer.
The Korean workers' movement has a long history of participating in the anti-war movement. And effectively what you're talking about is more or less a global campaign to disarm the world. How has the news been received by workers? We've spoken a little bit about the positivity and the hopefulness. How are workers' organizations responding to this news?
Most of the unions have, like KPTU, put out statements welcoming the agreement and noting the tasks that workers have before them in order to make sure that this agreement is implemented, to make sure that there is a good agreement reached in the U.S.-North Korea summit coming up and that that agreement is implemented, and then also to go forth to have exchange with North Korean workers. For us, we're talking not about just North Korean workers, but other workers on the Eurasian continent, in terms of how do we, as we move forward towards a peace regime and economic cooperation between these countries, how do we make sure that in that process, workers' voices are heard, that workers lead? So both that we are building a sense of understanding and solidarity with North Korean workers, but eventually that we're going forward to having a say in what this new Korean peninsula will look like, what the economy will look like. And as I put it in our statement, everybody has to share in the prosperity and the peace. And so it'll be workers, the role of workers, to build solidarity to make sure that happens. But in general, the Korean public, so workers organized and non-organized, are very positive about development so far. I think it's, you know, in the 80%, mid-80s or high 80% of all people in Korea who are supportive of the promises made in the declaration and moving forward on them.
When we've seen, I guess, the integration of post-communist states, it hasn't always worked out well for workers. Will this new peace agreement work in favour of workers' rights, or do you think it will simply signify a new level of neo-capitalist attacks on workers and workers' organising?
I think that that is left. We can't say that it will be one way or the other. At this point, what we have to say is that we have a very important role to play to make sure that we can deal with, or we have strategies for confronting the difficulties that are going to come with economic integration. For better or worse, North Korea normalizing relationships with the United States and countries in South Korea and surrounding countries means that it is essentially being integrated into a capitalist economic system. And that obviously, as you mentioned, can easily come with attacks on workers. And there will be the difficulties that you saw in Germany and other countries that, you know, integrated after the fall of the Soviet Union or around that time. The issue of vast differences in wages between workers in, let's say, North Korea and South Korea, problems of immigration, problems when, for example, we talk about connecting through North Korea to the continent with roads and railways. So we're going to be meeting a whole bunch of different workers with vastly different conditions and experiences. And so we have to, it's going to be a really important task for us in the next phase to talk much more concretely about what a workers' platform for how all of that should happen and how we can make sure that all workers' rights are protected in that process. And we have to be ready to fight for them.
Well, I guess this is more a question for understanding the impact of the divide between South and North Korea. Would it be the case that some workers have family members on both sides of the border that they've not been able to see or interact with since the war?
That's a huge issue for workers and just Korean people in general, that there are thousands of families, tens of thousands of families that are divided, have been divided because of the division of the country, which happened in 1945 and then was solidified through the Korean War. And so there are thousands of people who have not seen loved ones for decades and decades. I have family in North Korea myself, and one of the hopes, of course, is that this will allow for family members to get in touch with each other in the not-so-distant future. In the past, there have been meetings of divided families, which are used as sort of, they're big events, and then families get to meet each other for a day or something. And the governments of North Korea and South Korea are already talking about those kinds of meetings. But hopefully we'll get beyond that to actually having a little bit more freedom to really visit and communicate. I can't say when that's going to happen yet, but there is obviously hope for that in the near future. And, of course, that is important for workers, as many workers are part of divided families.
Of course, who this peace agreement is attributed to is a big issue. We know that workers in South Korea have very much been invested in this project for a really long time. But, you know, those with power get all the credit for everything. So in conclusion, Wolsan, I guess my question for you is, will you be seconding Trump's nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize?
Because I would never second or support Trump's nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. This is a president who has been attacking immigrants and women and people of color in the country that he's supposed to lead. He's attacking Syria. He's taking measures to, you know, move to antagonize the Palestinian people by moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. He's a very violent person. And just until the end of last year, he was engaged in a vicious war of words and threats of nuclear attack with North Korea that brought us to the brink of war. So I don't think that anybody like that deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. I think there's a lot of questions, and it would take a little bit of, I think, a longer conversation to talk about why it is in this moment that Trump agreed to meet with Kim Jong-un and the North Korean leadership. It has to do, I think, with the instability of his government in the United States and needing a way out. It has to do with the fact that North Korea actually came out and said, we will fully denuclearize, and made it difficult for him not to turn down the offer. And it also has to do with the fact that North Korea is, for better or worse, again, looks like it's going to agree to some things that the United States wants, including more or less recognizing the United States' position in East Asia, which leaves for us clearly a task for the future to continue to use the opening created by the move towards peace in the Korean Peninsula to work for to fight against U.S. militarism in East Asia and work for an end to militarized competition in the region. And so, I think we have to understand that larger context. And that's how, you know, Trump is ended up at the table. But that doesn't mean that he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, tomorrow is May Day. What is planned in South Korea, which is where you are? What's planned for the day? And what's your message to those workers in North Korea that will very, very soon be joining your ranks in the Transport Workers Union?
Well, I don't know how soon that's going to happen, but yeah, tomorrow we have a large, the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions has a large has large May Day rallies all over the country, so that it's regionally dispersed. But I will be in the one in Seoul, and actually, and of course, we will be bringing up issues that are still huge issues for workers in Korea, like long working time. Or in South Korea, long working time and low wages and precarity. And those are issues that we're going to have to fight to overcome together with our North Korean counterparts at some point in the future. And so I hope that, they're willing to give us their insight on those things if and when we do meet in the future. And of course, we'll have very different perspectives, but maybe we can learn from each other. One thing I'll mention is that we actually have a delegation coming tomorrow to the May Day protests, from the United States. It's from U.S. Labor Against the War. So it's a coalition of unions and workers' organizations that formed first to oppose the Iraq War, but is now fighting more broadly for the demilitarization of U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. economy. And so we're hoping to also, within this context of dialogue happening on the governmental level, also build an analysis with our counterparts in the United States on, a way to work together to build a demilitarized economy and to stop U.S. intervention in Korea and East Asia and to create a more equal society for all of us.
That was Walsan Liam from the Korean Public Transport Workers Union in South Korea, and before her, Steph Rabusa from Anak Bayan. Both women were speaking about workers' struggles in their countries on this May Day. And that's all we have time for on today's program of Accent of Women. Accent of Women is produced in the Melbourne studios of Community Radio 3CR, with the financial assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. The show is distributed nationally via the Community Radio Network, with special thanks to the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. If you want to get in touch with the producers of the show, you can write to us at accentofwomen@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter or like our page on Facebook. If you want to hear this show again or any of our previous programs, you can download the podcast from 3CR's website. That's 3cr.org.au. Go to the Accent of Women page and follow the links to this week's show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Giselle Hannah, and I look forward to your company again next week.